What kind of traveling have you been doing in addition to your writing?
I've been traveling in the Pacific. I've been in New Zealand, Australia, New Guinea, and then quite a few, 50, as a matter of fact, Pacific islands.
Looking for turtles, no doubt.
Looking for endangered species, and one of them is men and women are an endangered species in a lot of Pacific islands. Life is very, very hard for them there. That my next book will be a travel book set in the Pacific, but in aid of that, I traveled really hither and yon there, to Tonga, to the Solomon Islands, to Vanuatu, to a lot of places that tourists don't go, and to many of the places that tourists do go, like Hawaii and Tahiti.
Do you take your family with you?
No, I went alone. I went in the company of a collapsible kayak that I set up when I got to a place and just paddled around. For example, I went to New Guinea and then flew to the Trobriand Islands, and paddled around the Trobriand Islands, camping on the beach and sleeping in villages. And then when it came time to leave, I simply packed up my kayak and took it to another place.
Now, in reading your travel books, it seems that you do normally travel alone, unless you hide your companions. It seems you kind of pick people up on the way.
I think that it's very, very hard to travel with someone. First, it's very hard on the person. And secondly, it means that your impressions are coming secondhand. If you're walking down the street with someone and you see something, and your companion sees something else, then you have sort of conflicting images. Or your friend might say, look at that funny old man, look at that man's tattoo, doesn't it look like a figure of eight? And if a perception is coming through another person, it seems to me like a secondhand impression. Also, when you're alone, you can be totally immersed in the culture. And if you're with someone else, you're always wondering about that person's comfort and health and general state of mind. I don't worry too about my own.
You also pack a tape recorder when you go, don't you?
No, I don't take a tape recorder. I have no electronics. For one thing, if you brought a tape recorder in the Pacific, it would probably be stolen very quickly. I had a Walkman, and that was stolen out of my hotel room very soon after I arrived in Tonga. Things break, you need batteries for them, they run down, they're unreliable. Anything, I just carry a notebook, a pencil, I have a shortwave radio, flashlight, that's about it on the technical side. But I have a lot of camping equipment. I carry a stove, for example. I have a stove that can take kerosene or alcohol, or it can burn gas, unleaded gas. A stove is a very, very useful thing because firewood is very hard to get on Pacific Islands.
That's what my wife and I should have taken to Europe, a stove.
A stove. It's a little cook stove that you get, the mountaineers take them. So I have a stove, a sleeping bag, a tent, pots and pans. I have a bag with a lot of lightweight stuff in it so that if, as it happened, I was on an uninhabited island, I managed very well for a week. I mean, I could cook. I have a water bag and stuff like that.
Because you really go out of the mainstream, though, don't you?
This was an uninhabited island is about as far off the beaten track as you can get. And yet, I was there, and a boat came by. A man was rowing past my tent. I was very surprised. He had anchored his boat in the channel. This was in the northern group called Vavao in Tonga, and he rode by and saw me, and I said hello to him. It turned out he knew my brother, and he had heard of me, oddly enough. But I was camping there. It's sometimes better with a tent because of the mosquitoes. That in a local hut, in a Pacific Island hut, there are lots of mosquitoes. In a tent, a good American tent with the mosquito netting.
How about a camera? That's good for retaining images.
No, I don't carry a camera. A camera is, I think, a very bad thing for a writer to have. You get lazy, you take pictures of things that you should be looking at, and they don't always come out, and you become obsessed with single images and not with the circumstances of what's taking place. I sometimes buy disposable cameras and snap pictures of things that, I don't know, a dead dog on the road or something like that, but I certainly don't collect images that way. My collecting material is done with a notebook and a pen. And every day I spend two or sometimes more hours writing. I do a lot of writing.
On the road?
On the road, yeah.
In a notebook.
Yeah, morning and evening I do it. I think that's what the difficulty of travel, and I think that's why a lot of travel books are so thin is that people don't do the homework involved. There's a lot of work that you have to do at the time that can't be done with a tape recorder. Not in a place where there's very heavy downpours. I was in a place where it rained every day for a week. Very heavy downpours. I was in a tent. I mean, I suppose a tape recorder, what good would that have done me? But listening to a shortwave radio did while away the hours. I was alone most of the time. The rest of the time, one of the most interesting encounters I had was with the King of Tonga, and he wouldn't have allowed me to tape record him. But you see, because I remember what people say. After I saw him, I went back and I wrote down the entire conversation. So I think that my journalist training has stood me in good stead.
Mm-hmm. So you actually write, and as well as taking notes, you actually write on the road, so
yes.
You don't wait till you get back to England.
I live in the States now, on the Cape, more or less, all the time. But when I come back, I have a beginning, a middle, and an end, except that it's ragged. It's everything that happened on the trip. Every day I write down everything that happened that day, every conversation, everything I ate, everything I thought, everything I read, everything. So it might run to about 8 pages, 5 to 8 pages a day, I would say, I write.
So it's a chronological process of taking notes.
And then afterwards, I sift it and I make it into a narrative. And I think the reason my writing, travel writing, and I think that my fiction writing is detailed too, is because I make an effort to put down the particular details of a city. For example, in Chicago Loop, I made an effort to first to stay in Chicago. This is a novel, granted, but I stayed there. I made notes about conversations I had, about the way people spoke, the things people ate, the weather, everything, and treated Chicago as though it was a foreign city, one that I had come to understand.
Well, to you it was a foreign city.
Yes, although I had been there many times, and people are more American in Chicago than probably any other city. I mean, of course they have immigrants there, but it is very much a heartland city, and it's the meeting place of the, particularly of the South and the West. Easterners, I think, gravitate to New York, but Southerners and people from the West and the Northwest gravitate to Chicago. It's the great city of sin in the heartland. At least Sinclair Lewis said it was, and I think it is true.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in reading Chicago Loop, which is a novel I enjoyed, the story actually could be set anywhere. You could have set this tale in Baltimore, Boston, Philadelphia.
I don't think so.
Cleveland?
I don't think Chicago Loop could have happened anywhere except Chicago or maybe New York, because Chicago is a city that you can get lost in, you can disappear in, you can become invisible, you can live a double life or a triple life or even more if you wish. In a very, very big, dense, labyrinthine city, anything is possible. You can lead an alternative existence. And the man in the book, who's a murderer, leads a very respectable life and also a very disreputable life. He is never in danger of being caught because the city is so big, and he has disappeared into the bowels of Chicago. In Boston, if you tried to live a double life in Boston, you'd get on a bus and someone would say, if I did, Paul, what are you doing here? What are you doing on this bus? Why aren't you in Medford where you belong? Or why are you wearing that hat? Or why are you dressed as a woman? Or whatever. I think that would happen in Baltimore. I'm sure it would happen in Philadelphia or Washington or a smaller city. There's something
Washington wouldn't apply. Washington is a different kind of city. That is, there are too many political overtones.
We sometimes get the impression that no one lives in Washington.
Yeah, there's a certain sterility about Washington. I know it's got crime and ghettos and this sort of thing, but I've been to Washington many times. I lived in Baltimore, in fact, and so there used to be, when I lived down there, there used to be the only Mexican restaurant in the entire Chesapeake area was in Washington, D.C., so I would go down there regularly. But there always seemed to be a kind of sterility about Washington that I never felt about Baltimore or Chicago or Boston.
Washington is what sociologists call a transactional city. It's a city where people do business. They make telephone calls, they send faxes, they write letters, they dictate letters to secretaries, and then they go home. And when they go home, they leave Washington. They don't actually live there. Of course, Washington is also it's a southern city, and I mean it has been. Part of Washington is very interesting. The business part of Washington is transactional. It's people from the suburbs, and the rest of it is on the other side of the river, and that's another story. It's a city of 450 murders a year.
Well, let's go back to Chicago Loop. Secret Lives, that seems to be an interesting phenomenon you're writing, because your last novel had a man with a kind of a dual life, and this is certainly the case with Parker.
Parker is the main character, and he indeed does have is leading a double life. He's a man who fantasizes. You know, Freud said that only dissatisfied and unhappy people had fantasies. Happy people never fantasize. It's hard to find someone who doesn't fantasize, so I don't know what kind of a comment that is about the rest of us.
Well, have you ever seen a dog at sleep, and he's running and purring? No, I guess dogs don't purr, do they? A cat's purr. Sometimes you see a cat at sleep, and they're dreaming something, and the animals always seem to be happy.
Well, I think maybe they remember things. I think there's a difference between remembering something, between memory and fantasy. You can remember. I mean, a dog obviously is remembering his last meal and wondering who's going to bark at next. But he's not necessarily thinking that he wants to, or fantasizing that he wants to belong to the queen and for the queen to pat him on the head, or he's not dreaming that he's turned into a cat or a bird. I mean, I don't think that the dogs fantasize. I may be wrong. Dog lovers might attack me for this, but I think there is a difference between fantasy. Anyway, we're talking about Parker.
Is that your view, that unhappy people are the people who fantasize as well?
Yes, I agree with Freud that dissatisfied, unhappy people, neurotics, which most of us are to a greater or lesser degree, fantasize about our lives, what our lives might be, what we might become. And fantasies are also fears as well as desires, that you're afraid that something will happen. You're afraid maybe that a woman may fear that she's going to turn into a man or not have children, or you may fantasize about having lots of children or meeting her future husband. And a man similarly may fantasize about sex, seems to be a popular one with most people, but he may fantasize about power or murder. In the case of my character, Parker, in Chicago Loop, his fantasies take the form really of putting personal ads in the paper and then holding the people who reply to those ads responsible for what happens to them after they answer them. And the ads, of course, like all personal ads, are tantalizing, fascinating to read. I read them all the time. And the people who answer Parker's ads are attracted by particular items in it. Those are the beginnings, let's say, of his fantasies.
Do you read The Village Voice?
I read them all.
The Village Voice is the best classified ads, and the most kinky.
Well, there's The Village Voice. The New Yorker Review of Books used to have some good ones. Saturday Review had some great ones. You know where you find strange ones, or the heavily coded ones, are in papers which are heavily censored, where there's a lot of repression. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, for example, has a habit of printing personal ads as correspond. Gentleman wishes to correspond with, or couple, and then the couple is described wish to correspond with so and so, and so it's like some enormous correspondence course of pen pals, but you know it's not, that there's something else there, and code words are often used in it. As I say, there are certain words that seem innocent on the page and are quite different in actual fact. They're euphemisms in the way that in England, where you see an ad placed dancing lessons or French lessons, never mean those things.
How did it happen that Parker apparently was so dissatisfied with his, quote, normal life that he had to create this secondary life for himself?
Why it happened, I think, is suggested in the way that he behaves afterwards. I'm not really interested in portraying a psychopath. I don't think psychopaths are really worthy of attention, because the reason for their behavior is the fact they're sickos. So you get the things they do fascinate people. They don't fascinate me. The murder in this book is not described. I'm not particularly interested in every gory detail. Spare me the details.
But it's implied to the degree that it's quite frightening.
I think Parker
is dubbed the Wolfman by the newspapers.
Yes. He's the Wolfman.
Which I think the listener can use his own imagination and know what that means.
A much better way, I think, is to use your imagination. And much more frightening if you're using your imagination. And the same is true with when people clinically describe sex. I mean, that's using medical words is never as arousing as when you're allowed to use your imagination. Anyway, his motive, I think, is revealed in his remorse. And I think the book concerns remorse. It's about guilt. It's about atonement. He's sorry that he did this, and he wants to bring this woman back from the dead, back to life, and to eliminate the thing that he's done. There is no way on earth that you can do that, though. And I think the worst thing about murder is that you can only punish the perpetrator. You can never resurrect the victim. And so the families of murdered people are in a terrible position of needing to punish the killer or needing somehow retribution, and yet knowing that nothing will bring their loved one back. I think the murderer, a sensitive murderer, might feel the same way. And as a matter of fact, I got the idea for the book, or the germ of the book, came from an English crime that was committed about 10 years ago, when the murderer said in his diary that he wished to change his name to that of his victim. And as an act of atonement, that he said, I've killed this young man, Smith, let's call him. I'm going to change my name to Smith, and I'm going to be Smith. But I thought, well, what if you carry that further? And the murderer changes his name to that of his victim, and then lives the life of his victim, moves into his victim's apartment or house, does the victim's job, and then becomes a victim himself.
Or tries to become the victim.
Or makes an attempt, yes.
Because I was waiting for Parker to commit another murder. I mean, he was always on the edge because he kept putting the classified ads in. He had another arrangement with a woman who turned out to be someone he didn't expect to be. So I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never did. I mean, that in a way was great suspense because every corner I expected him to do something like that again. I hope I'm not giving away too much in the air.
You're not, and I'm glad you found the book suspenseful because I wanted it to be suspenseful. He's not a mass murderer. He's a man who commits a murder, but like all murderers, holds the victim responsible, as I say. He blames holds the victim responsible for the things that he himself is doing. And I think that's true. I think people who murder are liars. They're cheats. They're deceitful. They're not just murderers. They have all the human failings that you can possibly have. He regains a bit of his, let's say, sensibility in his guilt, but still he's unable to do anything except sympathize and become like the victim. Originally, I thought the perfect ending to a book like this, the O. Henry ending, is a man kills a woman. He turns into the woman. He sort of wears women's clothes and he takes her on her identity and lives her life. And the logical sort of O. Henry-ish thing is someone kills him. But I thought a murderer would think that. He'd say, yes, I'm going to become a victim myself. Someone is going to kill me. But then he would have to make someone else into a murderer for that to happen. And he doesn't want to do that. So the ending that I devised is quite different. And I think, as you say, suspenseful, and I hope riveting.
Well, I'm glad you didn't pull O. Henry. That's almost passé. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of Ambrose Bierce lately. He hated O. Henry because he thought O. Henry ripped him off, because Bierce always had trick endings, even in his very realistic war stories. He would have a trick ending.
Yes.
And we don't write like that anymore.
No, life isn't like that. Or when it is, no one believes it. So really, what can you do? I mean, the terrible thing is that probably the best stories are almost incredible, and so you can't write them. But still, I think that you can approximate life, let's say, or reality, by making a book as ragged and unpredictable as life sometimes is. And I think that the only strength, the important thing about anything that's written is that it has to be read and believed. You want to hold the reader and persuade him that this has happened or that this could happen. But for the time that you're reading the book, the reader is engaged in the book, he has to be held by it. And I think credibility is the major thing, believing.
And even more than that, I was talking to Peter Straub recently, and he's an avid reader. What he likes to do, and as a matter of fact, he wrote a novella which carried this theory out. He believes that if a book is well written and the reader is attuned to it, he becomes part of the action. In one of his short stories, one of his characters reads so much that he becomes a character in the stories that he reads. Mm. And Straub feels that way himself, that he takes the identity of the main characters in the story, and the novel or the story just overwhelms him.
It's
hard to do, though. I mean, for a writer, that's a hard task, I would assume.
There is a detective story that I can't recall the title or even the author, basically, the story, you read this novel, it's a detective novel, and a murder has been committed. But by the time you get three quarters of the way through, you realize, reading the book, that you are the murderer. The reader of the book is the murderer and will be apprehended, or is wondering whether he's, may be wondering as he's reading. But the guilty party is the person reading the book. That's sort of out Straub's, Peter Straub.
Gee, yeah, that sounds like it would be hard to pull off.
Impossible, I think it's. But that's, in a way, that's a stunt. That's a literary stunt. In Chicago Loop, I tried actually to make it as realistic as possible. I think that to a large extent, the murder novel or the horror novel is play. It's a form of playing. And the opposite of play isn't seriousness, it's reality. And the game of gore, or the game of murder, is much less interesting to me than the reality of it. And I wanted to put in the fact that the Robert Mapplethorpe exhibition outraged a lot of people. It outraged me, for example, and I was deeply shocked by it when I saw it in Chicago. And I thought, I want to put that in, that Robert Mapplethorpe, the photographs. I wanted the main character, who is a murderer, to go to the and react to the photographs in the Mapplethorpe exhibition, and for him perhaps to visit it twice, once when he felt he was innocent, another when he felt he was guilty, and to put in the sounds, the smells of Chicago, of Evanston, the suburb, and I think just the coming and going of life in a city where you can disappear.
You're on a tour now, is that correct?
Yes.
Have you been to Chicago on this
Yes,
tour?
I was there day before yesterday.
How are they reacting to the novel?
The novel is actually doing extremely well there. It was selling like blazes at Crock and Brentano's and the other major bookstores. I was very sympathetically treated by all the interviews. No one said, "What right do you have?" In the way that sometimes people do, "What right do you have to set up? You're from Boston or you're from an out of town. Why bring your murders here?" But they were very kind about it, very, very friendly.
How has it happened that you have, you say you've left London now?
Well, pretty much, because of my travel, I've been traveling in the Pacific, mm-hmm. and it's much easier to get to Tonga from Boston than it is from London.
Well, how does that affect your family relationship?
Well, it's rather difficult, as a matter of fact. I mean, but I have, my son I have two sons, one's at school mm-hmm. in the States and the other in England, so it's just as well that I'm here because I can look after him.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting at some point, wouldn't it, to go to the Persian Gulf and the aftermath of all the terror there? I mean, you as a traveler, I think, probably would find that fascinating.
I would find it fascinating probably as a correspondent, more as a correspondent than as a traveler. It's very hard to travel in places where there's political or military disruption.
Because you look at life more as a sociologist, I guess, than as a journalist.
Maybe as an anthropologist. Yeah,
anthropologist,
or,
maybe.
Or maybe simply as a tourist, that maybe I'm just a sort of jumped-up tourist. I would go to the Persian Gulf, but I've stayed away from the Middle East because there's so much contention and so much danger. I don't want to die in a horrible little place for nothing. I would rather, if I have to die, I'd rather die of a mosquito bite in paradise, say in the Marquesas or in Tahiti. There are lots of mosquitoes there, lots of mosquitoes in New Guinea, but at least I'd be profiting by. Why should I die of a stray bullet or a stray mine in a place where people won't even speak to each other?
You're right, but I was thinking in terms of the aftermath. But still, the aftermath is still an aberration, I mean, a political aberration there. It's not, things aren't settled. We don't know what's going to happen there. It's not, people can't go about their ordinary lives the way they can in the Pacific area to a degree, and you can't see what they're really like because they still have their defenses up and this sort of thing.
I also think that one of the great difficulties about travel is that you go to a country and it turns out that it's not a country. It happens in parts of South America, in Africa, and certainly in the Middle East. A lot of the places there that call themselves countries are not country by any stretch of the imagination. For example, even Kuwait, although Kuwait is at the UN and we went to war for them, that's simply a desert emirate, isn't it? I mean, it's the MAO, the head of Kuwait, it's a sort of family affair. It's a lot of people who own some oil wells, and the border is disputed. Same with Iran, same with Iraq, same with Israel, for that matter, in Palestine. So do you want to go to a place that and say, well, here I am in Palestine, or here I'm in Israel, and someone reminds you, no, that's not, that's occupied land, or this is the West Bank, or that's not the West Bank, or this is something else. I'd rather go to a place that had a defined boundary, and more or less, and people who wouldn't ask me my religion. You know, that's a little depressing, too. The places that I've been, in New Guinea, in Tonga, in the Solomon Islands, take the Solomon Islands, for example, the people were extremely friendly. They've been there more or less for the past 30,000 years, and they're quite content. There's no great dispute about their boundaries. They're islands. An island has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I found just camping there and living the life of a Boy Scout and talking to people much more pleasant than I would sort of wandering around some densely populated city in the Middle East.
How do you make your travel arrangements, get your passport in order and your visas and all of that?
It must be
a nightmare if you go to a batch of countries in the Pacific.
You don't need visas for most Pacific countries. If you have an American passport, the only place that you need a visa is Australia, and it's good for the life of the passport. So you get an Australian visa. You buy your visa at the airport in New Guinea. Tonga, you don't need one. Fiji, you don't need. Most of these places want tourists, or they have the mm-hmm. vague idea that tourists are a good thing. So they welcome you if you appear to be, you know, reasonably respectable.
So in general, I guess you alternate a nonfiction book with a novel.
That's what I've been doing. Mm-hmm. As I say, I'm just publishing Chicago Loop, the novel, now, and my next book will be, I hope, if I finish it. I'm just starting to work on it. I shouldn't talk too much about it, but will be a travel book about the Pacific. And then after that, probably I'll write a novel. I do have an idea for another novel. But that's the way it goes. I need something to do. I have no other honest work to do, so I need to stay one idea ahead.
Well, I enjoy Chicago Loop. Oh, by the way, I see you're now publishing with Random House. I guess the deal run out with Putnam?
No, Putnam will be publishing my nonfiction from now on, and Random House will be publishing all my fiction.
Well, that's an odd arrangement.
Well, I write a lot of books, and it's convenient. I'm not the only person in this country who has two publishers, but if you write a lot, it's a convenient arrangement.
Enjoyed Chicago Loop, Paul Theroux. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.